KCSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on historian Pam Long, co-author of the book Obelisk, A History. Now, immediately, listeners should be saying, what? That's an unusual topic for Hearsay Culture, and I will concede that it is. However, this history, written in 2009 by four eminent historians, focuses on obelisks, these giant standing stones that came out of Egypt and came to symbolize a variety of important virtues and powers associated with governments, from piety to power to perhaps bigger concerns with regard to the use of power and the use of knowledge. In Obelisk, this very detailed history goes through the history of the obelisk beginning in ancient Egypt and continuing to ultimately the modern day. And these historians have traced not only the history of these giant standing stones, but also what they meant to the cultures that erected them. So there's fascinating discussion in the book about what these obelisks meant in during different times in the history, not only of Egypt, but of Rome, as well as continental Europe, other parts of continental Europe, and then ultimately the United States and elsewhere. There's also very interesting discussion we're going to get into that focuses on the engineering around moving obelisks. Because the authors of the book have, I think, very well used graphical illustrations from a variety of sources going back centuries to show pictures not only of obelisks and what they look like, but also of the engineering feats that were associated in trying to move these obelisks, and of course, moving them not miles, but yards, which was a challenge, of course, centuries ago. The book also, more broadly, and I think of particular interest to listeners of Hearsay Culture, focuses on information and knowledge, because obelisks ultimately also symbolized control of information and access to information, not only by way of their inscriptions, which are also discussed frequently in a book and that we'll talk about a bit today, but also in terms of what they represented about the knowledge and power of the society. A topic that we've discussed on Hearsay Culture often is the sharing of knowledge or the lack thereof, and how law and technology interfere with the sharing of knowledge or aid in the sharing of knowledge. Well, here the obelisk is a symbol, I think, from having read the book, of that ability to control information. So this is an unusual topic, but I think a fascinating one. I enjoy having historians on the show. Most recently, I had on Sarah Rose, who's a reporter who wrote a history of the tea trade in China. I've also had on Adrian Johns, who discussed his fascinating book, Piracy. Several years ago, I had on the author of The Jasons, about the scientific group, a group of scientists that did work for the U.S. government starting around World War II and to the present day. And now we have the opportunity to chat with a historian who is focused on the obelisk. So, without further introduction, I welcome Pam Long, an independent historian, onto Hearsay Culture. She is joining us from her home in Washington, D.C. via Skype. Pam, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Pam, let's start off with a general question about your background. For those that are familiar with you, your background and how you became interested in obelisks.
Well, I'm a historian of basically of Europe and of pre-modern Europe, and most of my work focuses on the 15th and 16th centuries, but I range very broadly and back to antiquity. And I wrote a book called Openness, Secrecy, Authorship, Technical Arts, and the Culture of Knowledge, in which was all based on craft and engineering writings. And so I got interested in obelisks because one of the great engineering tracts of the 16th century, written by Domenica Fontana, was about obelisks, and it was about moving the obelisk at the Vatican, at St. Peter's in Rome, And it included graphic details, extraordinary graphic details and illustrations. So I was going to have to use that as part of that book that I wrote, but I didn't have room for it. So there's nothing about obelisks in that book, but I started studying obelisks while I was writing that book.
And so the research that you were doing there, and you mentioned this, and I wanted to get into this later, but you've mentioned it now, and it's important. You have focused previously on openness, secrecy, and authorship. To contextualize that book without getting into great detail, what did that book focus on, and how did it lead you to writing about obelisks in particular?
Well, I was interested in issues of openness and secrecy and the sort of generalization that was always made was that, or often made, was that science is open and technology is secret. And I was working on early what we might call technological writings that seemed to be perfectly open to me. So that's how it started. And I started thinking about, well, is this true that science is open and technology is secret or not? And I found that, of course, the situation is much more complicated than that.
And complicated to start us off, how?
Complicated how?
Yeah.
I found, for example, that you can't generalize that, for example, in the ancient world, military technology was not secret. There's very little evidence that military technology was secret in the ancient world. In the medieval craft guilds, you begin in say the 13th and 14th century in Europe, there's lots of evidence for secrecy, but it's in different crafts and different places, and there are injunctions in the craft regulations to keep the craft knowledge secret. So there's evidence that proprietary attitudes toward craft knowledge really develop, and I argue that they develop in the medieval craft situation. But at the same time, you could write a book about your craft and dedicate it to a patron. And that openness was also useful in certain situations in exactly the same time period.
And I'll tell you, as I've mentioned to other guests before, although this would be the earliest time that I would do it in the show, certainly I invite you back to chat about that book. And that's an area of particular interest as well, not only to Hearsay Culture listeners, but also to the work that I do. Tying that together, though, let's turn towards obelisk. And as I mentioned in the introduction, this is a topic that we have not covered on Hearsay Culture. This book, as I mentioned also in the introduction, is the work of four authors. Perhaps you could just describe briefly the backgrounds of Mr. Curran, Mr. Graffin, and Mr. Weiss. Now, you are an independent scholar, but you've previously been a fellow at the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, a fellow of the American Academy in Rome, and you've had other affiliations. Describe the other three authors, please, and how you work together to put this book together.
Oh, okay. I'd be glad to do that. Now, first I should mention the real genesis of the project came about because none of us four, but because of an engineer whose name was Bernd Dibner. And Bernd Dibner was an engineer who invented a solderless electrical connector and patented it. That is, I've been told, was on almost every telephone line in the world. And so he made a lot of money, and he turned to collecting books, and particularly books about early rare books about engineering and science. And so I was and he created his foundation created the Dibner Institute at MIT. And I was there as a fellow in 2000. And that's how, along with this institute, which invited fellows from around the world, and there were usually 25 fellows at a time, in the history of technology and mathematics and science, there was his rare book library called the Berndt Library. And Berndt Dibner collected engineering books from the 16th century, and he was very interested in obelisks. So he really had the greatest collection, and certainly by far the greatest collection in North America of materials related to obelisks. And so I was there as a fellow, and the head of the Dibner Institute at that time was Jed Buchwald, and it was Jed Buchwald's idea before I was there at all to use these materials to write a book about obelisks. And then there was a display about obelisks using the materials at the library in 1999, and Ben Weiss was the curator of rare books at that time at the Dibner and at the Berndt Library. So that was really the beginning of the book. And then Tony Grafton, who is a historian at Princeton, a very well-known historian who's written many books, was drawn into it. And Brian Curran, who is an art historian and who now teaches at Penn State, and who wrote this wonderful book called The Egyptian Renaissance, The Afterlife of Ancient Egypt in Early Modern Italy, was in it. So we four began at the Berndt Library, and the first thing we did, it began in 2000, it took 10 years to write, and it was we were doing other things, we were all very busy, but we began by looking at the numerous materials that were in the library right there. And in fact, most of the many illustrations in the book Obelisk are from the Berndt Library, which is now, the institute is no longer existent. And the library, however, fortunately was kept intact and is at the Huntington Library in San Marino now. It's part of the Huntington Library collection.
And so the project itself, taking 10 years, obviously involved the four of you working in a collaborative research process. And I'm curious, as I ask this, because many listeners are professors or researchers, doctoral students, law students, and so forth. Perhaps you could describe what you would perceive to be the greatest challenge of doing research over 10 years involving four scholars who are busy doing other things.
This was a wonderful collaboration. The challenge at one point, I thought, well, this is never going to be done, so we'll just work away until we die, and then it'll be done. But miraculously, we did finish it. So that was a challenge to find time, because it took. Each of us read everything, went over everything, rewrote each other's material, we talked, we had hundreds, we weren't often in the same place at the same time, but there were hundreds of emails, and fortunately, we all knew each other before we started, but we all became very good friends, and it was really a wonderful collaboration, so that when we finished, it was very, I felt sad, like, oh, how unfortunate, we're finished with this wonderful project. We can no longer have, daily or weekly obelisk emails, but we still actually do communicate about obelisks.
No, it's fascinating to me. As an undergrad at Cornell, wound up taking courses from a professor who became a mentor of mine, and who I'm still in touch with, Professor George Boyer, who's a labor economist and really a labor historian who focuses on early 19th century, mid 19th century British labor law and economics. economics, and he's really an economist. And so I wound up taking courses on the poor laws, and again, areas where it would seem to have a narrow focus, in a sense, very real sense it does, but has broader implications. And so I can certainly appreciate, although George and I have not written a book together, having the ability to discuss a mutual area of interest at such length, and then obviously to come out with such an interesting book. Let's turn towards some basic introductory stuff, because I introduced what an obelisk was, but of course I'm doing it short shrift. Let me ask you a extremely top level question. What is an obelisk in terms of its size, its shape, its dimensions? Perhaps you can describe the physical features of what a standard obelisk, if there is one, looks like.
Okay, one thing about an obelisk that I guess I think in my mind of real obelisks and not real obelisks. But a real obelisk, that is an obelisk made by the ancient Egyptians, is a monolith. It's a single stone. And so the Washington Monument, for example, is an obelisk-shaped monument, but of course it's not a single stone. It's a masonry obelisk, you should say. But an ancient Egyptian obelisk is a single stone. When placed upright, it forms a square at the bottom, and it gradually tapers up as it rises. On the top, there's a pyramid called a pyramidion, or the ancient Egyptians called it a benben. And it was invented by the ancient Egyptians. Most obelisks are inscribed with hieroglyphs, but not all of them. Usually they sit on pedestals. And most of the ancient Egyptian obelisks are made of granite from one place, the Aswan Quarry in Egypt. Now, they don't have to be made with granite. Some of them are made with other stones, a few of them. But the great majority of them are made with granite from the Aswan Quarry. And granite is a very hard stone, very difficult to work with. Obelisks are extremely heavy. The largest standing obelisk today is standing at the Church of St. John Lateran in Rome. It weighs 510 tons, wow, and its height is about 105 feet. That's the largest standing obelisk. The famous Vatican obelisk at St. Peter's in Rome weighs about 361 tons. The obelisk in New York that stands by the Metropolitan Museum of Art weighs, in Central Park, weighs 224 tons and is 83 feet tall. So they're extremely large, but they're also very fragile. They can actually break. And so that's why it's so difficult to move them, both their weight and their fragility.
And do we have numbers on, or if you can ballpark, how many true obelisks exist in the world right now?
You mean obelisks made by the ancient Egyptians?
Exactly, that have survived through time.
I really can't, because this is why. Because I know there are about, I believe, 15 or 16 large obelisks. The problem is there are many small obelisks. The Egyptians made many obelisks, and some of them are quite small. And so if you include the smaller ones, which are in museums around the world, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'd say there are about 15 or 16, just a ballpark estimate, huge obelisks in the world.
Now, with regard to obelisks, and you mentioned a couple. So in terms of obelisks that those that are not obelisk historians would be familiar with, you mentioned a couple. Are there other famous obelisks that the listeners might be aware of?
Well, most of the ancient large obelisks are actually in Rome. So listeners who are familiar with Rome will be more familiar with obelisks than most other people, because there's the Vatican obelisk, there's the huge obelisk at St. John Lateran, there's an obelisk at Piazza del Popolo, there are many, there's the famous obelisk in Piazza Navona. Well, there are about 13 large obelisks in Rome. There is an obelisk in Istanbul. There's an obelisk on the Thames River in London. There's an obelisk at the Place de la Concorde in Paris, and there's the New York obelisk. So I think those are the most famous actual ancient obelisks. And then, of course, there are famous, there's the Washington Monument, mm-hmm. obelisk-type monuments. Probably the most famous is the Washington Monument.
And so, so your focus, Pam, is in the early history of obelisks, and so that's what we'll focus on primarily here today. And we're chatting with Pam Long, co-author of the book Obelisk: A History, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Pam, as I mentioned in the introduction, these are, aside from being really quite remarkable and stunning works of art, are also stunning works of engineering, which I want to talk about after the break in a little while. But they have come to symbolize, aside from the art, a number of values or ultimately, I guess the best way to put it is, a number of descriptions of societies. And one of the focuses that you discuss and your co-authors discuss in the book is the obelisk as a sign or a symbol of power. And so perhaps you could talk about that generally, and then I'll ask you some specific questions about how obelisks have been used in certain civilizations.
Okay, well, I think one of our points in the book is that obelisks as symbols, as they're moved, they're often moved, which is very interesting fact about them, but they change, their cultural meaning changes as they move from one culture, one place and one culture to another. But they often were associated with power. I mean, certainly with the Egyptian pharaohs, only the most powerful, most stable, and most wealthy pharaohs could make obelisks because they were tremendously difficult and costly to make. They took hundreds of men to work on, and they were dangerous to make. The men that worked on them often died. They were just extremely difficult to handle, and they did symbolize the power of the Egyptian pharaohs. The hieroglyphs have these elliptical or oblong enclosures in which is written in hieroglyphic the name of the pharaoh, and the pharaohs were connected to the Egyptian gods. The pharaohs believed that the Egyptian people had a very a polytheistic and very syncretic religion in which different gods could be added or taken away, but the pharaohs were connected to the gods, and so the obelisk symbolized their power and their connection to the gods. Now, when Rome conquered Egypt in the Battle of Actium in 31 BCE, Octavian, who became the Emperor Augustus, immediately started removing obelisks from Egypt and taking them to Rome. So that was obviously a symbol of his conquest of Egypt. But for the Romans, the obelisks symbolize, they often put them in circuses, which are their large elliptical sort of stadiums in which they had races. And the obelisk would be placed in the center of these circuses often. And they were connected to the power of the Roman emperors. So that's why there's so many obelisks in Rome. Because Roman emperors Augustus and then emperors thereafter would bring the obelisks to Rome and place them usually in circuses. Then when the popes in the 16th century began to reform the Catholic Church during the Counter-Reformation, they took the obelisks and moved them often, put crosses on them, and had changed their symbolism into a symbolism of Christian power and the power of the papacy. So that was a transition. And so the obelisk became something very different in a way, but still symbolizing the power of the popes. And then later, when the French, Napoleon conquered Egypt, and an obelisk was taken eventually from Egypt and put in and placed in Paris. And so obelisk became a symbol of imperialism, really. The British have an obelisk in the, these are 19th century transportations of obelisk. The British brought one to the Thames River, and then the Americans finally brought one to Central Park. So in each case, the obelisk symbolized a kind of power, as well as other things.
And you know, this may sound like a silly question, but I think it's a significant one. What you're describing in moving the obelisks, of course, are not situations where the Egyptians were asked, I assume. And that being the case, I'm curious to know if in any time during the history of moving these symbolic totems of power, there had been negotiations around moving an obelisk. In other words, has the movement of these objects been solely one of conquest and of building empire and of showing dominance, or have they had other scenarios that have not been as pointed as those?
Well, mostly no. And certainly in the period I've studied, the Egyptians were never asked. And most of the large obelisks were actually moved from Egypt by the ancient Romans. So this happened a long time ago. But the what the two obelisks called Cleopatra's Needles, the one which are a pair, one in London and one in New York, were moved in the 19th century from Alexandria. And there was some negotiation that went on, complicated negotiations that went on about those two obelisks.
We're chatting with Pam Long, co-author of the book Obelisk, A History, on KZCU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the station as well as to Hearsay Culture. So with regard to the obelisks, Pam, the inscriptions are quite fascinating. In your book, you run through a number of them, and I'm curious to know if you found a theme associated with those inscriptions beyond naming a pharaoh. Are there any themes that would go towards sharing knowledge with societies versus extolling the power of a given leader or civilization?
Well, the interesting thing about the hieroglyphs and the reason that the hieroglyphs are connected with knowledge, I think, is really because they were not able to be read or understood. Hieroglyphic writing was not understood until the 1820s, until the Rosetta Stone was found in 1799 by a soldier of Napoleon's. As Napoleon was conquering Egypt, they found the Rosetta Stone, which was a stone that was used as a building stone in a wall, but that had previously been used to declare an edict. And the edict was written in three languages, in hieroglyphic, in Coptic, which is the an ancient Egyptian but more recent vernacular Egyptian, and in ancient Greek. And since ancient Greek was well known to all classical scholars, and Coptic was known too, finally hieroglyphic was able to be deciphered. And so it was really understood then, only in the 1820s, that that what the hieroglyphs usually said was, I am Rameses II, I'm the great conqueror of these peoples, and so forth. They're usually very, they're not rich testaments to extensive knowledge of the world. They really are statements of power of the pharaohs. But before the person that deciphered the obelisk, whose name was Jean-Francis Champollion, before he deciphered that, the hieroglyphics were really symbols of knowledge of all the world. And one could project onto them anything. And so, especially from the time of the Renaissance, there was much interest in the hieroglyphs and much speculation, and people such as Athenaeus Kircher actually claimed to have completely deciphered the hieroglyphs. And from our point of view, of course, he was completely wrong, but he wrote great tomes about the knowledge contained in the hieroglyphs. And for example, in the 16th century, one Michele Mercati wrote a book about obelisks. Mercati was a physician of Sixtus V, the Pope who had the Vatican obelisk moved from the side of St. Peter's to the front. And Mercati had this idea that what the hieroglyphs said was that they contained all the knowledge of the natural world. In other words, what we would call all scientific knowledge was contained in very encrypted and encrypted form. And that this is why, because according to this idea, according to the story in Genesis, had named everything in the world. And so by naming everything, Adam knew the entire structure of the physical and natural world. And this knowledge was imparted to the Jews. And so when Moses was in Egypt, he had this knowledge too. And he gave it to an Egyptian priest, Hermes Trismegistus, we think of as a mythical figure, but who was believed to be an Egyptian priest who wrote this knowledge into the hieroglyphic inscriptions of the obelisk. So the obelisks were taken to have the knowledge of the entire physical universe, basically. Mm-hmm. And this idea was then elaborated by Athenaeus Kircher in the 16th century. Athenaeus Kircher was a Jesuit sort of polymath who wrote giant tomes on all manner of things, including obelisks. So then later, the people groups such as the Freemasons thought of obelisks as sort of a container for esoteric knowledge. So this interpretation of the hieroglyphs, this tradition just flourished until they actually could be read in the modern world. And that sort of, I think, mostly ended it, although I guess it continues today among some groups.
So the power associated with being able to understand or translate, if you will, the hieroglyphs also becomes, I think, a topic of particular interest here, because aside from obelisks as a sign and symbol of power or knowledge, as you mentioned earlier, there's also a fascinating discussion, a book about the ability and the engineering feats associated with moving obelisks. And so I going through the book and reading it as a non-historian, it wasn't just the ability to take an object like an obelisk and remove it from one country to another as a sign of dominance, but also the very ability to do so that stood, I think, as a symbol of power. You spend in the book a good amount of time talking about the technology and engineering of moving obelisks. Perhaps you could describe the earliest efforts and what they entailed.
Well, the earliest efforts, of course, were made by the ancient Egyptians, and the ancient Egyptians did something that none of the other subsequent movers of obelisks did, and that is they actually created the obelisks in the quarry. So what they, and the thing that makes them also different from subsequent engineers who worked on obelisks is that they did not have, for most of the history, their history, while they were extracting obelisks from the quarry, from granite quarries, they did not have iron tools or instruments or machines. And so they had copper and bronze tools, but copper and bronze is simply not strong enough to work granite. And so they didn't use copper tools or bronze tools at all. To get the obelisk out of the quarry, they determined the shape of it, and they determined the inclination of the obelisk, and then they, after they surveyed it, in other words, and laid it out, and then they created a fire on top of it and burned it and threw water on the fire, and that allowed them to take the rubble off the top and get a smooth surface. And then how did they get the obelisk out of the quarry without iron tools? Or well, it's very interesting. There's a famous unfinished obelisk still in the quarry in Aswan, and by excavating this unfinished obelisk in the 1920s, they figured out that they actually used these round stones that are found in the desert there called dolerite stones, and they're very hard stones, harder than granite, and they actually bashed out, the hundreds of men stood around the obelisk and bashed out the sides until it was until it had spaces between itself and the rock bed, and so that the marks of this bashing look like ice cream cone scoops almost. And so they figured out that that's how it was done, and then they gradually used giant poles to lever it out of its bed. So that's the first part. Once you have an obelisk out of the quarry, you have to transport it by land and by water. And then that's the second part. And the third part is you have to erect it. Well, the ancient Egyptians, there has been a recent study, somewhat recent study by a German scholar, Armin Wersching, who revised the idea of how the obelisk were transported by the Egyptians on the Nile River, because it was transported from the Nile to wherever they were placed, in Thebes or in Heliopolis or in other places in Egypt. It had been thought that they were just transported on barges, but he figured out that by looking carefully at the pictures of obelisk transport in Egyptian sculpture and so forth, he argued that what they did was they made these special ships, and that the and that two of them would be together parallel, and that the obelisk would be held in the water between them, and so they would almost sink one of the ships, push the obelisk onto its support in between them, and then remove the ballast from the almost sunken ship, and it would come up, and so the obelisk would be floated between two ships down the Nile River. And then he figured out that the Romans, who had to transport the obelisk across the Mediterranean, much more difficult in a way, used this Egyptian technology, but put a ship in front of it, which would steady the whole, you know, apparatus and give more room for rowing and sail power. And that's how the Romans transported the obelisk to Rome. So then you have to, after you transport it, you have to erect or raise the obelisk. And the Egyptians did it with, it's actually, there's some disagreement about exactly what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it by using a sand platform and using levers and ropes. And basically they would bring the obelisk up a sand platform and then lower it into a hole at the bottom of which was the pedestal. And it was an extremely delicate, extremely dangerous operation, but they evidently did it successfully numbers of times, as we know. Now, when the Romans took the obelisk, they had iron tools and implements. So the technology completely changed. They used pulley blocks and pulleys. They used hemp ropes, and they used capstans powered by horses to move and raise the obelisk. So the engineering really changed. And ancient Roman engineering and the 16th century engineering was just the same as the Roman engineering. And we have the 16th century engineering we know in great detail because of Domenico Fontana's wonderful treatise about raising the obelisk. So the technology remained more or less the same until the 1870s when you suddenly have steam engines, steel cables, and hydraulic jacks. And so then, again, the technology changed again.
It really is remarkable. And, you know, we you know, aside from the awe of moving it, it's fascinating, a book, to see works of art that focus on moving an obelisk, something which today, you know, certainly we would, you know, very easily take for granted, but then was a great achievement. And again, I think showed that power from what we talked about.
I agree that the technological achievement reinforced the idea that the obelisk was a symbol of power.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. We have about 10 minutes left, Pam, which is where I get to the unfair question portion of the show, where I ask questions that you may not feel you have adequate time to cover, but I do my best to tailor them. I do want to ask you about the religious history of obelisks, which obviously is not something you could answer in 10 minutes, even in a short way. Let me ask you this question more specifically. You mentioned the Vatican obelisk, and you mentioned the Catholic Church's use of obelisks. Perhaps you can describe if there have been any controversies associated with, as you mentioned, changing the inscriptions and moving these items now not into empires or as symbols of power, but as symbols of religion.
Well, it's interesting. In the medieval period in Rome, obelisks were feared. It's thought that obelisks were not discussed very often, and they were feared because they contained pagan spirits, after all. And so there's evidence. There's archaeological evidence that the obelisks were pulled down and burned sometimes. But controversies, when the Counter-Reformation popes Christianized the obelisk, it wasn't really controversial. They had to do that to use the obelisk at all. The pagan spirits were still such a symbolic force that they had to exorcise the obelisk of their pagan spirits and went through an elaborate ceremony of exorcism and before the obelisk was properly Christianized and a cross placed on top of them. And most of the obelisks in Rome have a cross on top of them. But because the obelisk was such a symbol of became a symbol of imperialism in the 19th century, when the New York obelisk was brought to New York, it was quite controversial because, what was the American Republic doing with this symbol of the symbol of, first, pharaonic domination in a society that that used slavery, and second, imperial European countries. And so that became quite controversial in New York about what it meant and how to have it and like it, but also not have it be a symbol of an imperial country.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, and I'll point to in the book when you discuss the movement of Cleopatra's needle to New York. You quote an Egyptologist, Charles Moldenka, who wrote about his concerns, and I'll read a little of it because I think it's fascinating to see what obelisk came to symbolize. He wrote, "The oldest nation on the globe sends her greeting to her youngest sister. The setting sun has shed its last rays on the old world from Egypt's sunny land and now appears on this western shore as a brilliant rising sun. In the metropolis of the western hemisphere, one of Egypt's grandest treasures meets our eyes and, though silent, reminds us of her former greatness." And he goes on to talk about how it symbolizes the pharaohs, and then raises the concern that you've talked about. "Here in the Western land, the obsequious adoration of one man is no more. Here the people are not under the lash and miserable. They are with all their cares and labors a happy and contented people. The realm is not, as in those former days, the result of a despot's triumphant march, but a grand harmonious union of friends." And this is written in the 1870s. Of course, you know, we know that at that point slavery had recently been abandoned, but you know, we were far from a country where we were treating people equally. We have this in the United States, certainly at that time, an idealized version, a vision of what the country is. Can you talk a bit more about that controversy in the last couple of minutes before I ask you about a little bit about secrecy as well as your next projects?
Actually, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., there were controversies about what the obelisk might mean. And interestingly, in the U.S., of course, the most famous masonry obelisk is the Washington Monument. And there was a great controversy over the Washington Monument it was supposed to be a monument commemorating George Washington. And it was begun in 1824, but it was not finished until the 1880s. And so the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., and the New York Obelisk were really being erected about at the same time. And they sort of accrued to themselves the same kind of controversies, like what does such monuments mean? How if George Washington was supposed to be the president of a republic, why do we have this monument created by the pharaohs at our center? And so there were actually long controversies about whether the Washington Monument should be an obelisk, and if so, should there be inscriptions? There was a whole controversy about the stones to be used. Groups of people sent stones with messages inscribed. Should these messages be in the monument? And this went on for, during the Civil War, then the Civil War ensued. And it was very fraught. It's interesting because now the Washington Monument is just taken as a given, but it was a very fraught, an interestingly fraught monument as it was being built.
We're chatting with Pam Long, co-author of the book Obelisk, A History, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Pam, in the last couple of minutes, I do want to ask you whether you think there are any modern technological analogs to the obelisk, in your view. What do we have today that might be a close analogy, if any, to the obelisk and what it's meant?
You know, that's an interesting question. One answer is we still have obelisks. If you start looking, and so I don't really know of any that I can point to clearly. Because there's certainly no monuments that are as ancient as the ancient obelisks. But if you look around, if you start thinking about obelisks and start looking around, you find obelisks everywhere. You find them in cemeteries, you find them in town squares. I mean, so to some degree, the obelisk still functions as an important symbol and monument in modern culture. I really can't think of anything parallel. Can you? I mean, do you have any?
Yeah, the only thing that came to mind in a very abstract way, and I was thinking about what we do in the United States in particular, are presidential libraries. Every president, at least in modern history, has a library built that's supposed to not only house the president's papers, but show the president's interest. And, these are not, these are libraries that, of course, are useful to historians focusing on those presidents, but otherwise function largely as museums. And we build them, to honor a former leader. And so in a loose way, I thought that presidential libraries might meet some of the, aside from obviously being a large statue built out of a single piece of stone, the symbolism and what they came to mean, I think, to me, seemed similar to an obelisk. Do you have a reaction to that?
Well, I think that's true in part, but the thing about an obelisk is that it can be moved. And a presidential library can't be moved either physically or culturally. Like, you could not put a presidential library in the middle of, say, China and have it mean anything. But you can move an obelisk. I mean, obelisks have been moved all over the world, practically, and they mean something different. They're just, simple enough in a way, and they're ancient, so that they have this ability to change their cultural meaning as they go from one place to another. And that's why they persist in modern culture, I think.
Pam, in the last couple of minutes that we have, literally 2.5 minutes or so, perhaps you could talk about your next projects, what you're focusing on now.
Well, right now I'm obsessed with, and I've been for some time, I'm writing a book called about engineering in Rome between 1557, in the city of Rome, between 1557 and 1590. So it begins with this terrible flood of the Tiber River, and it's a cultural history of engineering in a 30-year period. It is also the period in which the Roman obelisks were first moved by the Counter-Reformation popes, Sixtus V. But it's not just about obelisks, but it's about building streets and sewers, and about bridges and roads and pavements, and it's all about the process of doing these things, the controversies between the Council of Rome, the city government, and the popes, how these engineering projects affected the people that did them, the workers, and the people that used them, and the social engineering that went on at the time. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Well, I will certainly invite you back on the show once you have that in a form that you'd like to discuss on the air, because it sounds again like something that is right up the alley of hearsay culture. Pam Long, independent historian, co-author of the book Obelisk: A History, thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture and sharing what I consider to be not only fascinating but very readable and fun book about the obelisk.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to mention several guests that are coming up as this quarter is coming to a close. This quarter will end at the end of May, and in the next few weeks, I will have on the show, among others, professors Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord of Elon University School of Law, my colleagues, discussing online sales taxation; Professor Mario Biagli of the UC Davis School of Law, director of the Center of Innovation Studies; and then closing out the quarter will be Professor Kevin Warbach of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. The schedule this quarter got a little thrown off because I had a death in the family, and the result is that a couple of guests that were scheduled for this quarter will be rescheduled and are being rescheduled to be on in the summer quarter, which will begin at the end of June. So there'll be a few more shows, three more shows this quarter, and then KZSU will be in their interim schedule, and there won't be new shows on Hearsay Culture. However, I will be recording shows in June that will begin airing in July, late June, early July. And among the guests that will be on will be Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants, Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, and Professor Michael Risch of Villanova University School of Law. I am going to be, I am extending invitations for guests coming up this summer. If you have any suggestions about guests, or if you have any feedback on the show, please let me know by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to the show. You can listen to the show live on KZSU this quarter, Tuesdays at 4:30 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU Stanford. You can also get the show by podcast by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's page in iTunes, by going to Stanford CIS's homepage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. Thank you very much for listening to Hearsay Culture today and for listening to KZSU. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.